So welcome to your second class, I think, on visual arts. And the subject is then high culture and popular culture in visual art in Britain since 1945. And I think one of the things that's becoming clear, I hope, is that high art and popular art, or high culture and popular culture, are not two separate pieces of sets of works. In fact, they are two principles of artistic production which are mixed in different ways. So, for example, if we look to there at Anthony Gormley, the man who built the arches all the way up England, from one point of view, there is one might consider that this is high art because it's quite intellectual. He's no doubt studied a long time, and so on. On the other hand, it's in the open, everybody can see it. It's not difficult to understand. And I think we will find this again and again, and I will repeat it, that high culture and popular culture are two principles, but you normally don't find them in their pure form. Even if you take something like rap, you will find that some rappers use references to literature, which is normally high art, yeah? And if you take opera, sometimes the opera will try to introduce themes of everyday life, which we normally associate with popular culture. So we need to look at how these interact, these two principles of high art and popular art, and not consider that they are completely separate. That makes it difficult. Yeah, but difficult is good. You're in university. It's supposed to be difficult. I'm going to present to you then a few more of the... Je me suis trompé sur le nom là. C'était l'autre qui faisait les arts. C'était pas Gormley, c'est notre. One or two more artists, well, probably five or six more artists from Britain, who have a particular relation then to high art and popular art. Anthony Gormley, for example, and his most famous piece is this, The Angel of the North. Did I mention this last week already? Yeah, okay. No, I didn't. Good. Okay, this is, it's in the, as you can see, it's not in an art gallery. It's an enormous piece on a big hill above a town in the north. I think it's somewhere near Newcastle. And the title is The Angel of the North. And the reason for it is that the North in England is an identity. It's important to people that they come from the North. Just like in France, you have les gens du Sud-Ouest. Est-ce qu'il y a des gens du Sud-Ouest ici? Aucun. Mais comment vous survivez sans les merveilleux gens du Sud-Ouest? Okay, but perhaps you know that when you're from the Southwest, you're in the Southwest, you're proud of the Southwest. We have the best foie gras and so on. Well, in England, this is not Scotland, yeah, the north of England is an important identity. And this is the reason that the government, or the regional government in the north, found some money to produce a symbolic statue of the north, the Angel of the North. Just like you have the London Eye, everybody knows the London Eye and Big Ben. Well, in the north we have the Angel of the North. It's enormous. It looks rather, reminds me slightly of the huge statue of Jesus above Rio de Janeiro. I haven't seen it, but I've seen it on the telly. That kind of thing. So this is Anthony Gormley, and he does a series of public sculptures. So notice they are public, they're for everybody. But they are, you know, rather modern and not always easy to see exactly what's going on. This is Anthony Gormley then again. This is an interesting piece because, in fact, these are actually on a beach. The sea comes in and out. There's a group of them. So a rather original way of producing a sculpture. First of all, the beach. Now, the beach in England is a very popular place in the French sense of the term. It's a very working class place because people with money go on holiday to France or Spain or Italy. The people who go to the beach in England, it's very working class, and so there is a certain, this is art for everybody. So Anthony Gormley was trained as a high sculptor, but this is art for everybody, and people do like them, the different positions that they come with. And here we're coming with further again with this idea that today we like artists, every artist, to do something completely new. That's difficult, to do something completely new. Now, if you go 150 years ago in 1900, generally, you know, you paint a picture, okay? And it might be a little bit new, but you paint a picture. Whereas today we expect artists to go, and sometimes they go too far and we don't understand anything. Yeah, but this is something completely new. It's an original idea. And of course, not everybody likes it. Now, that's the end of my first group of artists. I have some more artists in a moment, but first of all, I wanted to talk to you about the Turner Prize. Turner was an English painter from the 19th century. And in fact, if you're lucky enough to go to London, at the Tate Britain, there was a special gallery for Turner, which it's kind of, I don't know, post-impressionist, perhaps. And we're very proud of Turner. He's the great, because of course, all the great artists of the end of the 19th century are French. You know, Monet, Manet, not many English people. So Turner, we're very, very proud of Turner, because we got one. But the Turner Prize today is the most prestigious prize for contemporary art. If you are a contemporary artist and you win the Turner Prize, wow, that's the very top. However, it has to be said that the committee who give the Turner Prize, their priority is originality. Yeah, they want to give the prize to something extremely original and perhaps even very avant-garde. So sometimes it can be rather difficult for us. And you will see some of them here. The 2010 Turner Prize was won by Susan Fuchs for a performance where she sang old sailor songs at three places in Glasgow. Okay, so quite an original view of what is a work of art. Yeah, so there's nothing physical, it was just a performance. She sang a traditional sailor's song at three important positions in Glasgow, positions which are symbolic of the history. Now, I'm not an expert on this, I don't know much about it. And she won the Turner Prize, so you could see that they were looking for something rather different. And I have more examples too. This piece of sculpture won the Turner Prize in 2011. And it has a title. Its title is "Do Words Have Voices?" Do words have voices? Yeah, it's supposed to make you think. Do words have voices? Do words have voices? I don't know. Do voices have words? Yeah. So it's a rather conceptual and, you know, not easy piece. And you know, you can like it or not like it, but it impressed the committee in any case. This is what The Guardian said about it. Now, The Guardian is a bit like Libération, you know, it's the sort of liberal newspaper. And they are talking about, you don't need to learn all this, you don't need to write it all down, but they're talking about this. And this is what they say about it. "With his quietly atmospheric, lyrically autumnal sculptural installation, recalling a melancholy urban park with its metallic trees and scattered paper leaves." Is that what you thought when you saw, oh yeah, that looks like a melancholy urban park with its scattered leaves here? No? Maybe. Okay. "With its scattered paper leaves, Martin Boyce has been announced as the winner of the £25,000 Turner Prize." Notice it's £25,000. So it's not really a lot of money. It's a lot. If I give you £25,000, it's a lot of money. But you know what I mean? It's not a huge prize. Boyce was narrowly the bookies' favourite for the prize, ahead of painter George Shaw, who chronicles the scrubby, dilapidated suburban streets of his native Midlands. Boyce, 44, is the third Turner Prize winner in succession, either brought up or educated in Glasgow. After Susan Phillips last year and Richard Wright in 2009, a fact that confirms the now indelible importance of the city to Britain's art world. Just as this is the Turner Prize of every year, you see it, but it has to be said It's a little bit controversial. A lot of people say, "Oh, yeah, I don't. That's not art. I don't understand it." You know, there's a certain conservative reaction to it, and it's true. It's not easy. It's not easy stuff. The Turner Prize for 2012 was a video. You can only see thing, and it was a video about a terrible fire in 1979. Again, these are, it's a piece, it's not easy to understand what's going on. Yeah, it's not supposed to be easy. And this is what The Guardian says about it. "This has been a good year for the Turner Prize. All the artists seem to me to deserve their place here. No clear winner, no obvious losers, but in the end, Elizabeth Price deserved to win with a 20-minute video that is as finger-clicking and rhythmic, thanks to the music of the Shangri-Las, as it is painful and elegiac, dealing as it does with a catastrophic 1979 fire in a Woolworths department store in Manchester in which 10 people died." Okay. And 2017, this is the Turner Prize of 2017. So with a sort of collage side to it, yeah. So again, you're not expecting things to be tremendously easy. And here you have the winner. And this is Lubaina Hamid, who did this. "Described in February by the Daily Telegraph as the underappreciated hero of Black British art, Hamid made her name in the 1980s. As one of the leaders of the British Black Arts Movement, both painting and curating exhibitions of similarly overlooked artists. But now she has got the recognition she deserves. Her section of the Turner Prize exhibition in Hull contains work from the 1980s to today, including wooden figures, pottery and newspapers that she has painted on. The centrepiece is 1987's A Fashionable Marriage, based on William Hogarth's Mariage à la Mode, which features a cast of cutout characters, including a flirting Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan." Can you see Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan there? Where have they gone? They must be there somewhere. I'm sure they are. But I can't see them. Never mind. Okay, so the Turner Prize. I will come back to the Turner Prize later. Every year it comes out, and every year there is a little debate in the newspaper about, you know, is this really art? This is continuous about contemporary art. It continues to be controversial. Some things are not. I mean, if you at the time, Picasso was extremely controversial. Many, many people thought he was horrible. Now, there are many newspaper articles at the time. Whereas today, Picasso is generally accepted as interesting. But some of the contemporary artists is perhaps a little too far ahead. Let's have a look at another artist. This is Martin Parr, born in the north of England in 1952. And he is a photographer. And photography has a particular place within artistic production today. First of all, because it's relatively easy and not expensive to do. It used to be, you used to need a lot of money. Today, 50 years ago, you needed a lot of money to make photographs, to make a lot of photographs, because you had to pay for every one. Whereas today, as you know, even a telephone makes good photographs. And if you're interested, you can do a lot of stuff. Now, that makes the job of the artistic photograph more difficult, because there's photographs everywhere. And this is Martin Parr, what he does with it. And he tends to take pictures of working class life, which are kind of at a tension somewhere between the pathetic and the touching. So they often don't appear to be, you know, oh yes, they must be having a wonderful time. But on the other hand, you know, they are, in a way. That tends to be a bit of a theme. He also likes the colours. It's a nice Martin Parr picture. Would you like to eat that? Yeah, maybe you should give it to your dog, yeah. Again, very, very typical, you know, just a slice of life, an ordinary day, not a special day, an ordinary day, an ordinary person, not a specially chosen, specially beautiful person. Are these happy photographs or sad photographs? Is he mocking them? I suspect he is not mocking them. because there are so many of them that I suspect he is not. But they are quite very interesting photographs. This is one of my favourite ones. Can you see where they are? Can you see where they are? Yeah. Are they on the beach?
No.
They're inside. It's a false beach. This is it's a real place. You see, in England, it rains all the time, and so you can go to the false beach. And so what is he doing with it? And there's lots of people. On the one hand, of course, these people are all here to have a good time, to have a bit of a break in life, which is rather stressful. On the other hand, perhaps you could see it's a little bit pathetic, you know, artificial, crowded. Yeah, would you like to go there on your holidays? Yeah, it's a little bit, you know, you can understand that they're having a good time and it's important for them. At the same time, it's a little bit, you know. Of course, this is a little while ago. Today, even the working class go to Spain on holiday from England, yeah? Just car factories. He also did something else, Martin Parr. As well as taking photographs, he also collects things. And he collects postcards. And he published a book. And the name of the book is Boring Postcards. The name of the book is Boring Postcards. And in fact, for 20 years, everywhere he went on holiday, or he tried to find postcards which are kind of boring. They're so boring, it's interesting. For example, this postcard is an official postcard produced when they built the M1 motorway, the first motorway, the premier autoroute en Angleterre. And so here you have, you know, pictures of the exciting motorway. This is historically very interesting, because when you had the first motorway, people were very excited. So, London to Manchester in 5 hours and not 15. Yeah, it was a big deal. And also, this was the beginning of the 1970s. It was, you know, progress. So it represents a moment. Whereas today, if you build a new motorway, you don't make postcards about it. And so it's a reflection on the development of the present, because postcards are an official presentation of an event. Another boring postcard. Special postcard when they built this nuclear power station. And of course, it's the same thing today. You might build a nuclear power station, you don't make a postcard for it. You wouldn't sell any postcards of it. So this is a... This is the artist presenting his collection to the public, but really it's to make you think, yeah? I said that some people say that the job of an artist is to make you think. And so it's, you know, it's thinking about how our view of particular scenes has changed since they made these postcards. This is my favourite one. It's when you go on holiday, you rent this small flat, this small chalet. And you can see you've got a view on the sea and a settee and three chairs. And again, it's not exceedingly sexy and romantic. But this was the real postcard at the time. Yeah, can you just stay with us at the back? I'm afraid you're dead now. I'm sorry. Okay. Another one. This is not the postcards, this is back to his normal photographs. Here they are on the beach, but it's raining, but they don't want to leave the beach. It is a little bit pathetic, isn't it? It's a little bit pathetic. But again, it's an idea of artistic production. Notice that this has elements of popular culture, because it's not difficult to understand or anything. It's presented for people. And his books are not so expensive. On the other hand, if you buy an original photograph by Martin Parr, it costs you a lot of money, because he's very famous, he's very well known. So then you get these intermediate situations. I now want to look a little bit at street art. Because street art, here we're getting somewhere where obviously we're closer to popular culture with street art, because first of all, you don't have to train in a specialized institution. although you might do. It's for everybody. And so when you look at when an artist is deciding, if that happens, whether to do gallery art or street art, here are some of the questions that he or she might integrate. Accessibility to the public. You could do street art anywhere you like. In fact, it's easier to do in the poor parts of town, because in the rich parts of town there are more police stopping you. Yeah? In the poor parts of town the police don't care. And so you can do it anywhere you like, that's good. There's the question of the identification of the public. Do people see themselves as, the artist painted it in my streets, so you know he's part of my community. He's not somebody who I have to go to the gallery to go into his world. And in fact, I saw this morning a beautiful piece of street art in my streets, just just outside Paris in Montreuil. Cost to the public, of course, there's no cost to the public; it's free. On the other hand, you have the disadvantages that normally, of course, you walk past the street art fairly quickly. You know, you don't stop. Cost to the artist, well, it does cost a bit of money. Cost time. If you want to make a living being a street artist, you've got a bit of a problem, really. You've got to find some way of making money because, you know, it's making money isn't everything, but it's way ahead of whatever's in second place. Yeah, l'argent ne peut pas vous rendre heureux, mais ça permet d'être misérable encore fort. The profit for the artist is a problem, you know. Profit, of course, is a word we don't like, but, you know, you've got to make some profit or you're not going to be able to make more art. There is a tradition in street art to use pseudonyms. Very, very different. If you are a gallery artist, you don't usually use a pseudonym. You don't want to be anonymous. You're a John Mullen artist, yeah? Whereas in street art, there's a tradition to use pseudonym, which is very ethical. It's part of the ethics, you know. You're supposed to be kind of, you have your name, but you don't have yourself put forward. It's not like the pop star. So there's a whole series of ethics here. What has transformed street art is the internet. It sounds bizarre, really, because you only need the street. But of course, the problem is, if you want to become a little bit known, you need people to see, not just the people who walk down the street. And of course, if you do your street art and then you take the photograph and you put it on your website, then people know it's you, and they can go and see it if they like, and then on the website they can see the whole collection of your work. You know, you've got an oeuvre, which before the internet was not really possible. Street art traditionally is more political. Not all street art is political, of course. But there's more politics in street art than in gallery art. In fact, if you go to the FIAC, the Foire International d'Art Contemporain, in Paris, you see 3,000 works of art, and two of them are political. I may be exaggerating a little, but it's really political art is... Now, of course, nobody thinks that all art should be political, but when you have 3,000 of this year's art and there's nothing or one or two political, it might be considered that there's a problem. Aesthetic standards, the problem here is how do you judge street art? Oh, this one is better than this one. It's easier in the gallery because you have them next to each other. And so these problems. I don't have the answers to these questions. These are just some of the questions that are brought up. And perhaps most importantly, subaltern messages. That is to say that street art often comes from below. And so you have messages about racism or about oppression. Because it's not supposed to. In theory, we imagine street art as not being painted by rich artists. We imagine it as being painted by fairly ordinary people, probably young, and so on. And we will see some of them. In fact, interestingly enough, can you name a British street artist? Right, exactly. That one British street artist that's been so successful, Banksy, that really they've become quite famous. Now this is quite impressive, you know, it's not quite difficult to do. And we will be looking indeed at him for a while. This is not Britain, but this is just an example I saw in the newspaper the other day. This is the border of America and Mexico. the United States and Mexico, and some artist put that as, you know, the Mexican baby who is coming to get you, Trump. Yeah. So very interesting, because of course, you know, there's a lot of artists, but I think this talks to people. Yeah, a lot of people are very worried about Trump's attitude to the wall in Mexico, and so this very simple idea, difficult to do, but a simple idea, and a real political intervention. Of course, it's more effective because afterwards it goes all the way around Facebook. Everybody who likes it shares. So the internet and the street art comes together. In fact, I suspect that if there wasn't the internet, this would be difficult to do. Because, you know, when you do it, it's a lot of work, and, you know, 100 people see it. Yeah. And so there is an element that you've got this mix of internet and street art, which has not been much studied. If anybody wants to write a thesis on it, come and see me. So first of all, let's have a look at Banksy. Now, Banksy is a very young man. He was born in 1974. I was 14 already in 1974. Just think of it. I'm old. That's terrible. Do you recognize this one? Notice what's interesting about it is that there is it's not signed. It's not signed. How do you know it's from Banksy? Yeah, everybody knows, but how do we know? It's because it appears on his website. So he puts it on his website, and that means it's mine. Yeah. But otherwise you wouldn't know. Otherwise you wouldn't know. So it's interesting. And it's a very fairly simple idea. Yes, a sort of young girl, not rich, and losing a balloon representing love, something like that. A fairly simple romantic painting. Not necessarily easy to do. And there it goes away. But this has a story. This is one of the most famous ones, one of his early works. And so it's quite famous. Did anybody see this story? Yeah. Could you tell us? Could you tell us about the story, please?
I guess it was to be sold, and it was destroyed.
Yeah. Exactly, yeah, exactly. It was used, so it's a painting, but it was also a performance intervention. Qui connaît l'histoire, Louis Lamette? Okay, donc je vais l'expliquer pour les autres. Well, I have here, what happened is, it's a Banksy, and Sotheby's, the most important auction house in London, wanted to sell it. It's very expensive, yeah? 100,000, 200,000? 150,000, very expensive. And when they sold it, something happened. And I will show you what happened.
Last chance at 850,000. 860,000. Fair warning. Can I sell it now? At 860,000. Last chance. Bastien, we bid in and sell it for 860,000.
Okay, so what's going on here? What's going on here? Wow. So you can see that what happened is that somebody bought the painting for £860,000, and then most of it was destroyed by the shredder, which the artist had secretly put inside the frame. Wow. So here we have something quite complicated. You have the painting, but this is what you would call performance art. Yeah, it's performance art. That the destruction is a piece of art. And you can see from the film is made by Banksy, you can see that he is, I don't have time to look in detail, but he is mocking the rich Sotheby's. And we'll just have a look through it again as I comment it here. What's he doing here? Yeah, so what he is doing is he is mocking. What is he mocking? Well, he's not going to tell you. You know, artists do not explain their work. It's your problem. But I think it's fairly clear that if he's a street artist, then the idea of art selling for £850,000 among very, very rich people is not his priority. And so he seems to be pleased to be tricking all these rich people for doing this. And now Sotheby's, who are the auctioneers, they assured that they did not know. They have said, now they said it, it might not be true, they said that they did not know. First of all, he filmed these people and they're making comments and says, yes, it's very interesting how the street artist has a very traditional frame, and this is very interesting artistically, the contrast between the street art and the National Gallery type frame. But of course, they could never imagine. Also, when he's filming the people, you know, this woman dressed in this ridiculous dress there. And so he's obviously choosing the people who he can laugh at a little bit, and then showing all this huge amounts of money. These people are on the phones to people who don't even want to see the art; they just want to buy it. Yeah, because that's what art can be speculatively. And so it seems fairly clear to be. See, notice all these Russians and Japanese, very important Russian and Japanese, extremely rich people, even richer than your parents, okay? I think, yeah. And there they are, and this terrible shock, because, you know, these people, of course, are these people who love art, and they've been destroyed. It's just a terrible, terrible experience for them to actually happen, and then he makes the video. Now, there's a postscript to this, because what do you think happened after that, yes? I can't hear you, actually. Yeah, exactly, yes. That, in fact, well, first of all, the person who had promised £860,000, of course, they could say, no, I bought a picture, this is not a picture. So they were the buyer was entitled to refuse it, but they didn't refuse it. They said, okay, no problem, because now it is something even more important. It is the biggest joke in the history of art exhibition, of art. And really, it's a big, big thing. I mean, also, it got around the world, yeah? Now, the only other thing here is that Banksy says, in theory, it should have been completely destroyed. But in practice, it was only half destroyed. And this is important because when it's half destroyed, you can put it in your hall and show, you see here is the half destroyed. It remains, yeah? So, but this is what Banksy, you see, Banksy says, in theory, it was going to be completely destroyed. Is this true? We don't know. Perhaps Banksy was happy to have it half destroyed, and so it's a double joke. Yeah, so it's all very, very complicated. But certainly the idea of making people think is something for Banksy. And certainly Banksy has gone much further than most street artists, because he's not just painting things on the street, he's done many more things. There you go, there you go. This is one of his classic ones. Quite simple, yeah? He not necessarily making any money. Did you know there was a Banksy in Paris? Yeah, there's a Banksy in Paris on the door of the Bataclan, you know, the terrible, terrible terrorist attack on the Bataclan a few years ago. And Banksy came to Paris and drew a woman crying on the door. And then somebody stole the door a few months later. So it's a terrible thing. Well, especially the Bataclan. Sometimes it's just a joke. Now, it's interesting, really, because they're very varied. This is quite political, really, because it's about, you know, gay liberation and law and order, and it's shaking people up a bit. Whereas sometimes it's just a joke. This is not political. This is just a joke, yeah? The lover hiding by hanging out of the window. Again, bit of a joke. This is a sculpture, yeah? This is a sculpture. A little bit symbolic because the telephone box, this red telephone box is disappearing in Britain. There's very few left, of course, because we don't use telephone boxes anymore. And so the idea of it being killed, what is being killed? British identity, perhaps. Yeah, so there is a certain reflection behind it. Sometimes he just paints things on top of, this is an advert, and he's just adding things to it. So very varied, a very varied production. Yeah. Very, very simple idea. It's just a tank or something in America. And he wrote, this looks a bit like an elephant. And then, of course, he put that on his website so everybody knew it was a Banksy. But this caused a little bit of problems because there was actually a homeless man who lived inside. And then somebody came and bought it because it was a Banksy. And so he had nowhere to live anymore. And so Banksy sent him money to have somewhere to live, which is a whole complicated thing. One of my favourites. This was a more ambitious piece because this was actually, this is just a photograph, but it wasn't a photograph. It was an amusement park. It was called Dismaland. Not Disneyland, but Dismaland, pour le pays des misérables, si vous voulez. And it was opened in England, and there was a whole series of installments, and here you have Cinderella and the car crash. Cinderella and the car crash, and the photographers and so on. This is in three-dimensional, a taille réelle en trois dimensions. Hein? And there was a whole series of, right, you could actually go there with your children and go on different rides. And it was open for a few months. Of course, it cost Banksy a lot of money, but he makes money making documentaries, and he finds money somehow. It's a slightly complicated business model. So again, this is about, it's not very complicated cultural criticism, but it's about mocking official cultural criticism. And there was another example which was very, very interesting. I don't know if you saw in the news, but there was a controversial wall in Jerusalem. Which stopped the Palestinians from going where the government didn't want them to go. And there was a lot of protests about this wall. And Banksy opened a hotel, a small hotel there, where you could go and sleep in the hotel. And when you opened the windows of the hotel, you could only see the wall. So it was the Banksy Hotel, but in fact it was a political protest against this wall and the treatment of Palestinians. So you get this political and happening and making people think, a lot of things going on there. Certainly more than in the general case. There you get, there's Dismaland then, you see. Now, I don't know how he managed to, with the copyright, because normally these characters are copyright Disney, but, you know, he seemed to manage. Other street artists in the UK, just to go through a few of them. Pang, 2016, does this political piece. I am a man, I'm a refugee from Syria. And so, obviously, it's very straightforwardly political, but also the idea is, you know, let's put the portrait of the people in the streets, because we only see them as numbers, you know, a number of refugees here. We have a personal approach to what it's like to be a refugee. Another political one by Dale Grimshaw. Also Dale Grimshaw. I've forgotten the name of the man who does these. Anna Lorini, an interesting example, because street art is dominated by men, like most things are, in fact. But there is a little space for women in street art, and Anna Lorini is one of them. It's becoming, in some ways, very much an international media. When you see the street artists in London, and you find, oh, he's from Argentina, she's from Japan, it's a very international sort of thing, yeah. London, for a while, was the place to be. The other place, if ever you're lucky enough, Sao Paulo, incredible street art. Five years ago, somebody paid for me to go to Sao Paulo, and that was amazing. I'm a great fan of street art, because I like this idea that it's for everybody. So, is it popular? Is it high culture? Of course, it's mostly rooted in popular culture, although sometimes they can be people who have been trained as artists, and sometimes they can interact with the high art world, like Banksy managed to do with the Sotheby's trick. Junto. Sometimes people are just unknown. Takes a lot of time. You can sometimes get government money to help you. Sometimes, not usually, but sometimes you can, because it's considered to be, you know, prettier than what it was before. And you can even sometimes have exhibitions. So this is an exhibition of street arts. So, for example, in the gallery, you will see the preliminary sketches and so on and so forth. Okay. Let's leave street art behind and look at this particular campaign. I talked to you about the Turner Prize, which is the most prestigious prize of contemporary art in Britain. But there are always some people who don't like it. And indeed, a group of conservative newspapers launched a new prize, not the Turner Prize. Okay? Because these are people who consider, oh, contemporary art, singing songs under bridges, videos of fires, this is not art. So these are more conservative people with a more conservative view of art who launched not the Turner Prize. Now, what kind of pictures do you imagine you will find winning the not the Turner Prize? Yeah? Yeah, oil paintings. Yep, something. Pictures of what do you imagine? Portraits. Yeah, portraits, landscapes, etc. Yeah, the classic things. You're absolutely correct. That's what they are. So let's have a look at them. So first of all, let me give you the story. First of all, a Burton artist is hoping a portrait of a pal will land him a £20,000 prize in a prestigious national competition. Simon Watson, 33, is one of 20 finalists from more than 8,000 entries in this year's Not the Turner Prize competition, which promotes real art above the often baffling conceptual pieces which dominate the real Turner Prize. Yeah, so it's a political campaign, really, attacking the Turner Prize. The competition was started by a national newspaper in protest at controversial previous winners of the Turner Prize, which have included Damien Hirst's cows pickled in formaldehyde and a mound of concrete poured into a derelict house. This year's Turner Prize judges had to choose between entries including two vases depicting child abuse, a mound of rotting apples, and a sculpture of blow-up sex dolls. However, Simon's painting, entitled The Groom Smoking, you know, Le Marié a few minutes ago, is now hanging in London's Mall Galleries waiting to be judged by a panel chaired by Lord Andrew Lloyd Webber, who owns one of the biggest private art collections in Britain. The panel also includes four of Britain's top artists, wildlife expert and Rolling Stones guitarist Ronnie Wood, landscape artist Tom Coates, portrait painter India Jane Burley, and portrait and nudes expert Andrew James. Okay, and so there they are. What do you think? Would you like to have one of these in your bedroom? So very, very classic, yeah? And so the defense of them is that this is that they correspond to what is real art. And of course the people who defend contemporary art will say, well, this has been done before. Yeah. This has been done before. We know this, so we don't need it anymore. But this is a debate which is carried out at a very high temperature. Yeah. People do not, in a relaxed manner, say, oh, you know, I really like contemporary art. Oh, I don't like it at all. No, it's a really very, very high temperature, because it matters to us how our world is portrayed through art. And whether it's painting or music, people get very angry about their tastes. I mean, I know people my age, a lot of people my age don't like rap. But in fact, it's not just that they don't like rap, they detest rap. I say, you know why? You know, where is this energy coming from? It's the end. It's the end. That's the end of this one. Okay. Calm down a little. So let me stop this.